My name is Craig and I'm the Marketing Communications Manager at the Royal Hospital for Neurodisability. I'm very pleased to be on doing one of our first podcasts. I'm here with my colleague. I'll let you introduce yourself.
My name is Catherine St. Georgie and I'm the archivist at the RHN.
So before we go into a bit more information about you and your role, Catherine, I was wondering if you could give us a brief overview of the RHN's founding and its history.
Sure. So the hospital was founded back in the middle of the 19th century in 1854. So around that time, the mid-19th century, as we all know, was a time of great medical advancement, particularly in the field of antiseptic anesthesia procedures. So treatments were much more successful and people were able to be made much more comfortable. However, it is really shocking to learn that there was very little care or treatment available for people with chronic illnesses. It's really sad that general hospitals could not spare beds for patients where there was no obvious cure or they required long-term care. In the mid-19th century, these patients had either the rather unfortunate option of going to the workhouse, or if they were poor, or if they were slightly better off, then if they were lucky, they had to rely on the support of family and friends.
So you mentioned the workhouse. What is a workhouse?
So the workhouse was a charitable institution that was set up to care for the poor and needy. And they were generally not very pleasant places to go, but it was it's either the workhouse or the church who looked after people who were needy at the time.
And it was mostly poor people that would go to these workhouses?
Absolutely, yes.
So the preference would be to go to family or friends if you had the money and support there.
Yeah, if you had that support. And of course, the workhouse is where they wouldn't really have the facilities to look after people who are sick. So yeah, they really weren't the appropriate places to go.
So this is where the RHN sort of starts its history, I guess, then. Could you walk us through how we changed things or how we were a part in the change of that history?
So yes, so it was so the charity was set up in response to the fact that there was no appropriate facilities for such patients, and there's quite a lot of people campaigning at the time. Some of them were quite well known, in fact, like the novelist and social reformer Charles Dickens. And in 1850 he actually wrote an article about the lack of care for patients whose diseases were considered incurable. And just 4 years later, the Royal Hospital for Incurables was established. Our founder, Andrew Reid, was a well-known and very well-connected philanthropist who had already set up three orphanages, a centre for people with learning disabilities, a savings bank, and a grammar school, most of which, in fact, are still in existence, which is quite a testament to him. So like I said, he was very well connected, and he counted Prince Albert, the Dukes of York and Wellington amongst his friends. So this obviously allowed him to raise the necessary funds to set up the charity.
It's interesting that you mentioned that we were called the Home for Incurables. You've already walked us through a little bit about how these people would be defined. So it's people with very little care or assistance available for them with chronic illness. So Andrew Reid sounds like he was a very well-connected man. He had a lot of important links in establishing funds for the charity.
Yeah.
Were there any other significant figures who sort of had influence over how the RHN grew?
Yes. Probably one of the most significant figures is Florence Nightingale. She actually advised us on the proposed site for one of the proposed sites for our hospital, because as we grew in size, we had to move quite frequently. And at the time, this was later in her career, she actually gave some advice on the suitability and design of wards, and she gave us suggestions on the amount of light and air required and the recommended cubic feet per patient, for example, in the letters which we actually still hold in our archives. She was actually a miasmatist, which meant that she actually believed in the now outdated theory that bad air rather than germs spread disease. But in any case, even though this is now an outdated theory, her letters are really interesting because the better ventilation and sanitation that arise from this miasma theory still obviously prevented disease and infections and is therefore still of quite big relevance to us.
Especially seeing as we've just come out of a pandemic and even air quality so. Has been a very big feature of that.
Indeed.
So Andrew Reid was obviously very well connected. If he knew members of the royal family and significant figures like Florence Nightingale.
Absolutely.
What is his background?
He grew up when he was actually the son of a watchmaker, and that was his first profession. But he actually found his calling and he became a clergyman. And like I already said, he set up various charitable institutions whilst also being a full-time minister to his church. He was also quite a creative man because he was well known for writing lots of hymns along with his wife, Elizabeth. So, yeah, quite a special man. And like I said, most of his charities are still in existence in some form or another, including ours. And although this hospital is his last charitable venture, it's quite incredible to think that he founded the very first hospital for patients suffering from non-acute conditions. And as such, we can say that this hospital had a very pioneering role in the specialism of rehabilitation and long-term care.
So it's really interesting to hear how we've had such a pioneering role in the specialism of rehabilitation and long-term care.
Yeah.
You mentioned we were initially set up as the Royal Hospital and Home for Incurables. Could you tell us a bit more about how we became the RHN and how some of our services might have changed?
So the hospital was initially set up to receive patients who were dismissed from the general hospitals, as Charles Dickens would put, as past cure. So there were no treatments available, hence this term, this rather contentious term, incurables. And it would apply to anyone who's not really able to work or support themselves. But obviously what was considered not treatable in the mid-19th century is very, very different to what is untreatable now, 170 years later. We can see from our admission casebooks that go all the way back to the 1850s that patients were initially presenting with conditions like you'd expect, paralysis and spinal injury, but also a wide range of other conditions such as infectious diseases like consumption and bronchitis, nervous disorders, which they termed at the time melancholia and hysteria, learning disabilities, crushed limbs rather horribly, rheumatic fevers, and even neurological illnesses such as epilepsy. But obviously many like depression and infectious diseases can now be treated with medication. As well as rheumatism, arthritis, and epilepsy now have very effective medications that, although they can't cure it, they can manage it better. There are also better prosthetics for injured limbs and improvements in diagnostics and treatments for paralysis and spinal injury, which of course means that patients are now able to live much more independent lives. So as time has gone on, the types of conditions that patients were presenting with has become a lot narrower. And from around the 1950s onwards, neurological disease has become the major cause for people to apply to the hospital. And we were beginning to see specific conditions emerging, such as Parkinson's and Huntington's. Fortunately, the hospital responded to these changes by introducing a big redevelopment program in the 1970s and 1980s. And we created new wings to accommodate young disabled residents, for example. We had our rehabilitation centre, our pioneering brain injury unit, and our vegetative state unit, which of course was the only one of its kind at the time in the UK.
We were the home for incurables.
Mm.
Obviously, that's a very contentious term for today's standards, and we probably wouldn't be getting a lot of support if we were still named that.
Yeah, in fact, Queen Victoria initially didn't provide her patronage at the time because she didn't want to be associated with an institution where patients were not cured. So that's why it took a little bit longer for us to officially get, although we were always known as a royal hospital, it took till 1903, I think, almost 50 years later for us to actually get officially get our royal designation.
Okay.
And so, 1919 was when we got our royal charter.
Okay. So he was a bit cheeky with it and kind of jumped the gun, I guess.
Yes, because he was, because all his other previous institutions that he set up had a royal designation. So he was a bit presumptuous indeed, but he got his way in the end.
Well, I mean, it worked out well, didn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah, so you mentioned we obviously changed our name at some point. When did that happen?
So, it's quite shocking actually that we only dropped the contentious word from the hospital in 1995, which seems quite late, when we officially became the Royal Hospital for Neurodisability. But even in the early days, like you say, incurable was not without its problems. For instance, there was an article in 1920 from the BMJ, I believe, the British Medical Journal, that recalled a patient at the hospital who had died when she was 90 years old. And that was actually an incredible 50 years after she was admitted to the Royal Hospital for incurables. So it's difficult to take the term incurable.
Yeah, she had quite a long
with
run.
With cases
then.
Like that.
She had quite a long run if she lived for 50 years
indeed.
After being admitted. So I think it just speaks to the quality of care she probably received, that we were able to sustain her for that long.
Absolutely.
But I suppose this is the nice part about your role and when your role comes in, because we only get to hear about these great stories through the work that you do and our archive collection. So what does your role entail, and can you give us a bit more information about some of the research and archive departments on the whole?
Yeah, sure. So my role basically involves the preservation of records that have some kind of long-term value. And at the hospital, these archives will normally be selected for their historic, scientific, or organizational relevance. And we really do have a wide range of archives. We're very lucky to have all the original volumes of board minutes going back to our inception, our earliest admission case books, lots and lots of photographs of events such as staff celebrations and royal visits, and interesting materials such as old fundraising materials such as our Christmas appeals, which have had contributions from very famous people such as Thomas Hardy, another 19th century novelist, and Otto Goldschmidt, who was a very famous German composer. So it's my job basically to index, catalogue, conserve and digitise these archives where possible, to ensure that they are in good order, in good condition, and searchable and accessible to researchers. And it's also my job to publicise the availability of the archive material to staff, patients, and the general public through various outreach events, such as blogs, open days, webinars, and talks such as this podcast. And we've been really lucky to have received a grant from the National Lottery Heritage Fund back in 2019 for the development of the archive. Before then, much of the archive material was scattered all around the hospital, and some of it, I heard, only very narrowly escaped destruction forever. And through the grant, we've been able to implement a new online catalogue and conserve and digitise a large proportion of our most treasured and fragile items. And the project actually concluded with an opportunity to create an outdoor exhibition in the hospital grounds about our unique history, which you'll be very familiar with, Craig, because you helped
Craig and Matt. We did a lot of work for
that. You did all the artwork for those panels, which looked fantastic. We got lots of compliments about it.
We had lots of people come in from the local community as well to kind of view it as well, didn't we?
Absolutely. And it was really nice when the patients and families walked around, seeing them scan the QR codes to find a bit more information. I think it's just really nice. It gave them a sense of collective memory and the sense that they were part of something bigger, you know.
Yeah, definitely, because we are quite a big grand building, and I imagine a lot of people drive past us quite regularly but don't fully understand or appreciate the scale of the input we've had in our field and as a hospital and a care home. So things like having the archives to reflect back on is really, really insightful, and it does do what you said and makes people feel as though they're part of something bigger. I think that's what the nice thing from our perspective was about looking at the National Lottery Heritage Fund project. It was a really insightful experience, I guess, and a lot of fun as well to realize how much input we as a hospital and as a community, but also seeing the similarities that were existent way back when and how we exist today as a hospital, as a home. It's really nice to see.
Yeah, it was a great opportunity for us to really get our archives off the ground and for it to be recognised by, you know, the wider, both the local community and academic researchers.
Yeah, but we're not done there, are we?
No, absolutely not. And we're currently in the process of recruiting some volunteers to help transcribe some of our admission case books and all our photographs so that they're even more easy to locate online.
So you're obviously very involved and hands-on with our archive materials. Yeah. Is there a particularly favourite object you have, or is... Yeah.
Yeah, I'm... it's difficult to, like a mum, it's difficult to pick one favourite. But probably, you know, obviously I have to mention our most treasured archive, which is, of course, our letters from Florence Nightingale. We have about a dozen of these letters.
And they're all handwritten, aren't they?
They're all handwritten. And they're mostly, like I said, about advising the secretary of the hospital on the proposed new site which is supposed to be Andrew Reid really favoured a site in Causden, which didn't actually materialise, but her letters focus on that, and also she also advises us on the recruitment of one of the matrons, one of our longest serving members, who's rather formidable, stereotypical type of matron, from what we can tell in the archives, called Mrs. Lineker. I have to pick those because, although as an archivist I can appreciate the value of digitization, you know, to conserve and to improve access, there's nothing like holding the actual article in your hands, particularly for such a historical icon as Florence Nightingale. But there are some other favourite objects as well. Obviously, most of our records are usually on paper, but any archivist will tell you that there's all kinds of weird and wonderful objects that tend to turn up in archives and are kept because they have some kind of informational significance. For example, we have a walking frame from the 1930s that we bring out for visitors to see during our open days. And people love trying it out, and they're quite amazed in how smoothly it still operates. We also have an interesting collection of scientific equipment that was donated to us by a former medical director. And this includes, they date back, we're still researching into the, exactly how far back they go, but we think they go back from the late 19th to early 20th century. They include things like an old blood pressure monitor, an old respirator, a hemometer, quite a few of those actually.
What's a hemometer?
Which I've later found out it's actually used to measure the amount of hemoglobin in blood. So I guess with heme, I suppose, yeah, you can work it out with the prefix, blood, hemoglobin. hemoglobin. And I also found a small box, which is labeled silkworm gut. And as you can imagine, I was a bit nervous when first opening that up, didn't know how gory that would be. In fact, when I did open up, it was just some kind of thin, strong looking strands. Again, good old Google. It turns out that silkworm gut was actually used as surgical suture.
Wow.
So yeah, we have have that in the archive as well. I'm not sure how old it is, but anyway, luckily not too gory. Yeah, so this is, like you say, it's part of my job is always learning new things and discovering new things, and that's part of the fun.
And when you're not so sure, perhaps jumping on Google to make sure something's safe to open.
Always. No, actually, I think I did jump in. I didn't Google before I jumped in. I was brave.
So yeah, that sounds like we've got quite a collection of objects, and there are opportunities throughout the year for people to come in and sort of look at some of these objects. I know we did some work with a group of refugees recently, yes. And they came in to sort of experience some of the history, which was lovely to see. Mm-hmm. But moving on, aside from objects, we've also had some quite significant people in modern times come to visit us. So could you walk us through some of the visitors we've had?
Well, I mentioned our links with the royal family, and we've been very fortunate to have most of the royal family come in and visit at some point or another. The Queen Mother was a patron for many years, and she came in about 5 times. The Queen herself came in 3 times. Princess Diana came in a couple of times. Our new king did as well. I came in once. Princess Anne, Prince Edward, they've all been here. But not for a while. I think the last visit was maybe 2005 or something like that. So we're due one soon, anyway.
Yeah, we're overdue.
And yeah, we also get well-known visitors as well. For example, we had the pop group Westlife come in a few years ago to film one of their... Very randomly.
I vaguely remember Westlife.
Oh, come on. I definitely remember them. So, yeah, they came into one of their videos, Safe, I think it was, because we have these lovely original stained glass windows by one of our staircases, and that made a lovely backdrop for their video.
Amazing.
Indeed.
So we've not just had an influence over medical history, we've also had a... influence in pop history.
Pop stardom, yeah, absolutely.
Claim to fame. I've got a question for you that might seem a bit niche, but obviously we're quite an old building. And if you've ever been here late at night, you do tend to get a particular vibe. I heard a rumour that we might be haunted. Do you have any information about that?
I do, actually. I think you met this ghost, in fact, didn't you?
So I have had an experience, yeah.
Confirm the myth. But yes, apparently, I don't know if this is going to scare you even more, but the ghost is reputed to be that of a lady called Marie Manning, who, along with her husband, was apparently the perpetrator of the notorious Bermondsey Horror in 1849. So her and her husband were supposed to have shot her lover and buried him under the kitchen. And then they ran off with some of his money, but they were caught and sentenced to death. Randomly, this was the first time that a husband and wife were executed together since 1700. And Charles Dickens makes another appearance in the hospital's history, because he was present at the hanging and afterwards protested against public executions being quite a horrible spectacle.
So not a friendly ghost then?
Well, she might have improved in the past 100 years.
I mean, there's a lot of time to improve one's character, isn't it?
Yeah, who knows? I mean...
a lot of time for some deep reflection.
Well, how did you feel? did you feel threatened?
My experience was very weird because I was alone in the office one morning, and my colleagues used to love sneaking up on me and jumping up on me. And this one time I felt somebody stood behind me. So as I turned to the left to see who it was standing behind me, I felt somebody touch my shoulder on the right. And by the time I swung around in my chair, nobody was there. So it was a very creepy experience, but I was definitely touched by something.
Oh my goodness. So you didn't really make out a figure or anything?
Didn't see anything, but I felt a presence and I felt something on my right shoulder as I turned. Yeah, very creepy.
Nothing since, just that one.
There's been a few weird noises. A few of my colleagues have also reported being here late and hearing some objects moving. We did actually see a flower pot move on its own once as well, so that was also quite freaky.
Okay, so I wonder if it's good old Marie.
So it very well could be.
I just need to add that bit there, the link with the hospital.
I was just about to ask about that, because it's very bizarre that she would
why
connected.
Her, why yeah, would she why, come back here, here all the way from Bermondsey? The link with our hospital is that Marie served as a maid to the daughter of the Duchess of Sutherland, who used to occupy our building before we bought it.
Ah, so that's her connection. So she's lingering on from them.
Yes. Yeah, it's a bit of a tenuous link, but yeah, that this is the legend.
I mean, it's a very nice building. So if I was a ghost, I would definitely choose to move in there.
Yeah, why not? Yeah, in fact, we have quite a lot of famous people that used to live on our site, because I think quite a lot of people were surprised. In fact, I was surprised when doing my research quite how many high-profile people lived here. Like most manor houses in the Wimbledon area, there is a link with the Spencer and Churchill family, the ancestors of Princess Diana and Winston Churchill, of course. But there was also a link with the Pitt family, the famous Pitt Rivers family, who had such an influence on politics in the 18th century. But beyond this, we also had a Scottish baronet and the Duke of Sutherland, obviously, the husband or the father of who had the maid with the ghost. They also used to live here. And the original mansion, I'm finding a bit more information about the building, that the actual original mansion that we bought on the site was apparently built in 1789 by a merchant from Hamburg called John Rucker, who also has quite an interesting backstory. But our reception area, our lovely reception area with all those lovely side niches and relief friezes, and the library as well with that beautiful ceiling, they're part of the original mansion.
Oh wow, cool. So I mean, we're quite fortunate then to have somebody like you at the hospital, because not a lot of places would have access to all of this information, somebody to sort of like catalogue it and pull it all together then. So we're very lucky to have
Thank you for saying.
And I'm sure the local community find it really interesting as well. And even for staff, I know that it's a big part of our recruitment push to sort of, you know, say we've been going for this many years, we've got so much history here. And it sort of builds the character of the RHN. Mm-hmm. So just one last question before we move on. We obviously want people to keep listening to our podcast.
Yeah, of course.
Because they're going to be about a whole range of topics. But one idea we had was getting our guest speakers to ask a random question. You don't know who the next speaker is going to be, but at the end of their podcast recording, we're going to ask it to them and see what their answer would be. So do you have a particular question that you would like to ask another colleague about?
Actually, it's more of a test for them.
Okay.
Because obviously part of my role is to, make people more aware of the archives that we hold and our history. So I'd like to ask them what they think our most valuable archive is in the hospital.
That's very good, and I'm sure we'll have lots of interesting answers for that.
I look forward to hearing it.
Perfect.
Bit of pressure on them, though.
Definitely. Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I'm sure we'll get you back in the future as well to do more podcasts.
Absolutely.
Because I know we've got loads of stuff, and maybe around Christmas we'll see you again.
Of course.
To go through some of our archived Christmas appeals. But yeah, okay. Thank you very much.
Look forward to it. Thanks very much.